Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Oh, yeah. And a lot of fun today.
This was great. And a lot of bullets, because we deal in lead,
friend. We're going to talk about The Magnificent Seven, directed by John Sturges in 1960.
Mm-hmm.
And, wow, cast. Yul Brynner, Eli Wallach, Steve McQueen, Charles Bronson, Robert Vaughn, Brad Dexter, James Coburn.
Brad Dexter, you lucky dog to be listed in there.
Oh,
everyone goes, who?
Oh, wait, now we can't forget Horst Buchholz.
Oh, Horst, is this where he got his start? Poor Horst Buchholz. He's probably like, no, really, I was in this movie, guys. I was a main part.
Yeah, he played Chico.
I know. I didn't even know he had a name until I saw that.
Right.
He was that kid who couldn't, you know, who was a braggart.
You know, you hear these stories about, you know, older Hollywood and things. I assume this kind of thing still goes on. You know, people haggling over the order in which they're shown. You know, their credits are shown and things.
Yeah.
So at the opening of Magnificent Seven, you know, they say, you know, Yul Brynner, Steve McQueen, Eli Wallach, you know, and it goes on. And then at the end of the cast list at the opening of the movie, it says, and introducing Horst Buchholz in huge letters.
As big as the title.
Huge letters. Yeah, I know. I just imagine these guys just rolling their eyes and saying, what?
That definitely goes on. Rose was telling us that there are all kinds of meanings for people who do the contracts of when you get the, at the end, you'll get with so-and-so versus and so-and-so.
Really?
And how big the letters are, where they're positioned, that's still fiercely worked out.
Huh.
Sometimes with blood, evidently. Maybe not literal blood, but, you know, a lot of mental anguish.
Yeah.
Depending on how important people are. And in fact, I was just talking with a group of people yesterday about the King's speech. And the cast list at, in the beginning of the movie had, and Michael Gambon, if that's how you say his name, G-A-M-B-O-N. And I was like, well, he's clearly important, but the name does not ring a bell. I don't even know who he is. And he plays King George the VI. He plays the king's, you know, eventual king's father in that. I was like, oh, I guess I should know who he is, but I don't.
Wow. It's amazing that, you know, that's negotiated and things, but imagine if you're putting tiny letters somewhere that matters too. I mean, if you're, you know, if you've got, if people don't know who you are, I mean, it's not helping you get in work, is it?
Right. And, you know, think of Hollywood as such a land of egos, as we found out in this movie. So in the background material. But so The Magnificent Seven, is there anybody who hasn't seen it? If there is, you should stop listening and don't waste time with us.
And you know, I thought I'd seen it, you know, and I'm not saying that I didn't see it. I have seen it in the past, but it's wonderful. It is such a great movie. It's been years and years and years since I've seen it, but I just thought, oh my gosh, this is really something else.
I'm so glad.
Yeah.
When you said it had been years and years since you'd seen it, I was literally shocked. I not that I watch it every year, but I know I watch it more frequently than that. I've seen it six or seven times. And the music came on. I went, oh, yeah, it's been too long.
Oh, and the music was great.
Oh, yes.
Iconic music.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's the kind of music now that's referred, strains of it will be used in a referential way to mean a Western.
Mm-hmm.
Actually.
Yeah.
And yeah, so basically it is and I had forgotten it starts with a Mexican village that's being raided by banditos, I guess you would say. It's led by the famously bad Eli Wallach, who is just magnificent.
Yeah,
as
and talk about an interesting choice of cast. Wallach is the leader of this. Whoever thought of that was pretty smart, but, you know, I would have seen that and I said, that'll never work.
Didn't he always play bad guys, though? I think I remember my father telling me that.
Really?
Because,
I don't
know. This is the kind of movie that would come on a Saturday afternoon, and your dad would sit down and watch, and then he'd kind of sprinkle you with facts, if he was like my dad, about, oh, Eli Wallach, he always plays bad guys. Or, and I think his autobiography was called The Good, the Bad, and Me.
Huh, because he was in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, right?
Yeah, right. So, but he and wasn't he a villain?
Surely he was. Or yeah. wasn't he, I don't know if he was a villain. I thought he was like a sidekick. But yeah, it's been a while since I've seen that too, so.
We clearly didn't do our research, but you know, that's hit and miss. Yeah, that's all what interests us. We're not professionals here, people.
I think that I'm most familiar with his later stuff. So he's cast often. Well, I don't know. I'm looking at his list here. When I see him, I recognize him.
Yeah.
But he's always playing, you know, he's like on a whole bunch of TV series here. And like, I was in this episode of that or this episode of that. I think that's, you know, he's usually somebody's dad.
Oh.
You know what I mean?
I completely missed that phase of his career. For me, he was from the 60s and probably the early 70s. And he was always, you know, a magnificent villain in a sense. I mean.
Yeah.
But maybe that's just the kind of movies my family watched, too. I don't know.
Well, but in this, anyway, he was great. I did enjoy
it. He is so great because he's kind of got this... he's bigger than life, but not in a scenery-chewing way. He's just kind of very casual and conversational and confident of himself. And he is just... my husband especially said, I've never really paid attention to him. He goes, but he might be my favorite character right now because... he's so practical.
Mm-hmm.
He's got to feed his men. He's very down to earth when he's dealing with the gunfighters. He's the first thing he does is go, oh, okay. Oh, they got seven of you. Well, you know what? Let's split it. We're the same. And you know, that's when Chris Yulbrunner is going, we're not. And he's like, no, we pretty much are. We all know the kind of people we are. I'm just going to treat you like equals. Let's just all take them and I'll split the take. It's pretty good here. So he's just always, and he always keeps that very camaraderie sort of feeling with them. But so they're being raided. They're like, we can't get any more to eat. What are we going to do? We're going to starve and he's going to come back. He's already promised this. So they go to the wise old man who lives in the hills above the village, and he says, you've got to fight. Go buy guns at the border. So they go to fight. They go, and what you see next is some frontier town where Yul Brynner, Chris Adams, and Steve McQueen, you know, two of the best tough guys ever, are sticking up for, I guess they're actually sticking up for what's right.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, and in a very altruistic sense. And then after that magnificent scene, they've impressed a lot of people. And the Mexican leaders, I guess these three guys, try and go hire Yul Brynner. And for me, that was the first real kind of defining moment, I guess it is supposed to be for all of us, where they're like, here's what we've got. And he's like, that's it? And they say, well, this is everything our village has. And he says, well, I've been offered a lot for my work, but never everything. So he takes the contract and says, he basically says, because they want him to teach them how to shoot. And he says, well, you know, men are cheaper than guns, which in itself is kind of a commentary.
Mm-hmm.
And so he starts hiring however many guns he can get for $20 and food to go down to the border. And as Steve McQueen puts it later, shoo some flies away from a little village. And then you have the classic, you know, gathering the group scene of gathering these individuals together. And you have seven.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, they have six. And there's one kid who's a wannabe.
Yeah, yeah.
Who eventually
That's Horst Buchholz, yeah.
In his magnificent premiere. Horst, if you happen to hear this, sorry. It's, you know, just nothing personal. But it's like a classic Hollywood thing. And here's so-and-so, our next great star.
Mm-hmm.
Nope, sank like a stone. Yeah, so he winds up joining them, and then they have to go down and confront the villains. And it's them against seven of them against 45, I think, of this band of village and they whoever they can teach of the villagers. And so what happens is you start to see all these really interesting contrasts. There are the contrasts between all the different kinds of gunmen. Because as Yul Brynner points out to the Mexican people hiring him, he says, you know, we're not all the same. We do the same job, but not for the same reasons. And so there are the different contrasts between them. You've got Robert Vaughn, who I meant to look up and see if this was before The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which is where I knew.
It was, yeah. Yeah,
okay, because I was like, this is a pretty good move for him. I mean, he's playing somebody who's got a little depth here in terms of he's had a crisis and he's terrified now of dying. That's a problem for a gunman.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you've got at the other end of the spectrum, because they range for all the, you know, there's the guy who's in it because he's like, you wouldn't do this for $20. There must be treasure somewhere. He's always looking for the big score. Up to Yul Brynner's character, who is very honorable.
Yeah.
And everybody in between. And then there's the contrast between them and the bandits, between them and the villagers, because the villagers are shown much more nuanced than you would think in a lot of ways.
Yeah, And I thought it was interesting on the Horst Buchholz thing.
Uh-huh.
He was genuinely concerned about this kid. You know, right. I was like, well, you know, I don't think you're qualified. You know, this is kind of dangerous, and gives him this little test where he, you know, just shows his speed, you know, and says, you know, can you do this? He's clapping his hands before, you know, you can pull the gun out. Anyway,
yeah,
the kid fails miserably and just runs away. I mean, he's so full of pride and anyway, he just can't handle the fact that he failed this test.
Yeah, the graveyards are full of boys who are very young and very proud.
Right.
That's also the first moment, though, you see the wisdom of the head of the Mexican guys who said, we've got to do something, because he just kind of shakes his head and says, oh, he's very young and very proud.
Yeah.
And you say, oh, he's got more insight than just, we've got to have help.
Right.
So anyway, yeah, I'm sorry.
Another moment for him was when they're in a bar looking for more guys, and somebody comes by with a scar. And he says, well, you know, so one of the Mexican guys says, what about him with the scar? And then that same guy says, we need the person who gave him that scar.
And Yul Brynner goes, you've got it.
You're learning, yeah.
Yeah.
That made me laugh out loud. It was funny. Yeah. And this movie is fun. I mean, the whole thing, it's just fun. Yeah.
Because it's such a classic, and to me, it's a classic American movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I know this is where everybody says, oh, but it's based on The Seven Samurai by Kurosawa, Akira Kurosawa, the famous Japanese director, who I think, isn't he credited with the kind of inventing this sort of a movie where you go gather your band together and then go on your quest, so to speak?
But, yeah, I'm not sure.
When I was looking at information about the director, it says he once met with Akira Kurosawa, who told him he loved The Magnificent Seven and gave him a samurai sword. And Sturgis considered this the proudest moment of his professional career. So I think for me, that kind of made it, I don't want to say okay to love it as its own movie, but you don't have to always kind of refer back to it. And in a sense, to me, what it did was show you can take this and reinterpret it and make it into something that for your own people or for other people is kind of a defining piece also.
Yeah.
You know, the base art is that good, basically.
Mm.
Because it's got everything. It's got that glorious landscape. It's got the magnificent, I keep saying this, but it's got the magnificent cast. It's got the magnificent music that's so Western. And it's the classic struggle of, you know, good versus evil. When do you keep your word versus when do you just do what's expedient and run away? Because the gunfighters are kind of, at one point, everybody's going, you know, sometimes it's really just better to go. They'll be okay.
Yeah.
And Yul Brynner saying, no, I made a contract. And what he really means, if you're an American, you understand. When you give your word, that's how it should be. You should stick with it no matter what. That would be the ideal.
Yeah.
But, and for a Christian, it's that idea of contract versus covenant.
Mm-hmm.
Because a contract is, what am I going to get out of it? A covenant is, each of you gives 100% no matter what the other person's giving later. They may back out, but you're still going to give it, because that's what God has made with us. And we're continually trying to live up to our part of the covenant. We fall down, but we come back. No, I'm going to still try to give you 100%. God always gives 100%, even when we're not keeping our part of the bargain. And that's, to me, I looked at that and went, he can't use that word, but that's what that means.
Hmm.
You know, my word is my bond, essentially.
Yeah, that's neat. Yeah, yeah, and then there was another layer to this that struck me, was the whole, you know, is it really a good thing to be a gunfighter thing?
Oh,
you know, where, you know, everybody idolizes us and they think we're the best, you know, and we are walking around and we are awfully cool. But,
oh yeah,
we don't, I mean, there's a scene where, you know, they're making this list of, you know, kind of what's good and bad about doing what they mm-hmm. do. And the fact that they're alone and they don't have a family and they, you know, all this stuff, that was really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And that theme kind of played from there to the rest of the movie too.
Yeah. And even it's kind of interesting that the Steve McQueen character, the number two guy,
mm-hmm.
he continually would bring that up because it was kind of expressed very lightly through his continual, where are the girls in the village? I don't see any girls. What about, but by the end, he's kind of saying, well, I was kind of hoping, like, you know, you might have been, this is why I care. I was thinking I could settle down.
Mm.
I don't have to live this.
It's almost like his character, he wants to settle down, but just can't.
Right.
He can't possibly do it. And, yeah. So it was interesting that, you know, Buchholz did, or Chico, or whatever his name is.
Right.
Realized it, but before it was too late, you know, before he became Steve McQueen.
Right.
He was able to leave.
Yeah, yep. Because he's the link and the contrast between mm-hmm. the farmers who, I don't know if you could call them heroes, but they're presented as the essential ultimate good.
Mm-hmm.
They're what everybody should strive for, essentially. You know, between right. people like Steve McQueen saying, I want to settle down. You know, you've got people who scorn them, like the Eli Wallach, Calvera, that's it, who says, if God did not want them sheared, he would not make them sheep.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's right versus might, I guess, is the ultimate David versus Goliath.
Yeah.
On a lot of levels.
Yeah, I mean, it really was something. And then somebody who surprised me in this movie was Charles Bronson.
Yeah.
I mean, his character, you know, kept being followed around by these kids. And the kids would say, mm-hmm. you know, you're the hero. You guys are all the heroes. And he was like, no, you know who the heroes are is your dads are the heroes. You know, because yeah, I don't have anything to lose, is what he was saying.
Well, I printed out his little speech. Do you mind if
I say? Yeah, no, please do.
Although mm-hmm. I can't do the accent like Charles Bronson, because that's just, you know, he says... Because they say, oh, we're proud of you. We're ashamed of our fathers. They're cowards. And he grabs them and he says, don't you ever say that again about your fathers, because they are not cowards. You think I'm brave because I carry a gun? Well, your fathers are much braver because they carry responsibility for you, for your brothers, your sisters, and your mothers. And this responsibility is like a big rock that weighs a ton. It bends and it twists them until it finally buries them under the ground. I have never had this kind of courage. Running a farm, working like a mule every day with no guarantee what will ever come of it. This is bravery. That's why I never started anything like that. That's why I never will.
Yeah, wow. That was a very surprising thing.
And he always loves the kids, because even mm-hmm. at the beginning, he's making a little flute when they're having the parade, the village celebration of their founding.
Mm-hmm.
And he's playing it. A little girl turns around and he gives it to her, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So it's like he's he's kind of personifying what they've lost or what they've given up mm-hmm. to do what they do.
Yeah, because his name is, they're calling him Bernardo. And at one point, Yul Brynner says, what's your name? And he goes, well, actually, that's my real name, Bernardo O'Reilly.
Mm.
Mexican father, or, you know, one parent Mexican, one parent Irish, and me caught in the middle.
Yeah, yeah.
So he kind of personifies that whole struggle.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, as we're sitting here talking about it in the context of this podcast, I think about the priesthood.
Oh.
I mean, it just came to mind, you know, when we're thinking about this, if what they've given up, you know, and that's interesting thought. I haven't thought it completely through, but that just occurred to me.
Yeah, because they give themselves 100% to God.
Mm-hmm.
So he can use them as our shepherds.
Yeah, and I'm sure
the same language.
I'm sure plenty of them really feel what they've given up, you know.
Well, in that sense, maybe, but I would say in that sense, it's more like when you get married.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you finally find your one true love. And you don't stop and look around and go, oh, I could have married this person. Oh, I could still be playing the field. Oh, I could. So I think for a priest, it's more like you found what you really want. And you might see that ache sometimes because, like, we'll see people who didn't have kids.
Yeah.
I think I've mentioned this before. And they're going on Italian vacations all the time, or they've got this great little sports car. But then we look and go, oh, but look what our kids have brought to our lives, the richness. How could we give up these people? We can't. And so I think for a priest, once they've made the decision, but it's trying to make sure that's the right thing, because Hannah's got a friend right now who feels called to the priesthood, but he's trying to discern. So he has been living actually at Cistercian Abbey here, and but he still hangs out with them. And I'm like, how does that work? You know? And she goes, well, pretty soon he's going to have to just be with them mostly, because he's going to start studying and doing all this stuff, and then that'll be more of a real discernment period.
Yeah, that's something that, you know, it's real interesting about the Catholic Church. It's like you don't just get to be a priest. You know what I mean? And, and even if, you know, if you're wanting to be Catholic and you're going through RCIA and stuff, it's not like this is going to take 3 weeks and you're going to be Catholic now, you know? There's this period of discernment, and it's like, okay, we're not in a hurry here. Let's just relax, take a deep breath, and let's think about this a good long time. You know, so it's that way with from RCIA all the way through the priesthood. It's kind of a remarkable thing.
You know, when you bring that up, it is. It's like in the movie, you can't just strap on a gun.
Yeah, which is what Buchholz was trying to do.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But they want you to think and discern and and understand kind of in a sense what you're getting into. It doesn't mean you can't turn away anytime you want. And that's stressed through that whole period. And gosh, RCIA, the period between when you start the classes and when you come into the church is 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And people will say, so long? And I'm thinking, well, do you want to make important life decisions in less time than that? I don't understand people who just like flip churches.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and that happens.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. And so for the priesthood, they want to make sure, despite what people might think. And I know, cause I was on the outside and I heard and believed all that stuff, but they want to make sure that that's really what you should be doing. If you, for instance, if you're a boy, like a high school boy, they want you to have, you know, have you been dating? Have you been, want you to have experienced some life. We don't want you to run away, be running away from something. You have to be running toward your love, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a good thing, you know, even with this priest shortage and everything, we're still not in a hurry. And I think that's really good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and I don't know about where you are, but our seminary numbers here are going up.
Yeah, I've heard the same thing, that kind of everywhere we're on the upswing, which is great.
I know. Mm-hmm. I think it's that return to orthodoxy, if one might call it that, to the basics of Catholic life.
Yeah.
Kind of that coming back into balance after Vatican II.
Mm-hmm.
Which takes 40 to 50 years after any great council to kind of, for everything to kind of swing back into balance, because everything's got to find its level. It's like opening a dam and having the water rush through.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. But yeah, I've heard the same thing, that we're all just kind of in a good period here. Mm-hmm. Where things are getting better.
Yeah, that's always good.
Which is always great. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and this movie, if you think about it in terms of discernment, which is what Catholics would call that period of, you know, do I want to be a priest? Or, I mean, it's kind of like that same period of, you know, you've been dating someone. Do you really love them? Oh, well, let's get married. Let's get engaged. Let's get married, whatever.
Sure. Yeah.
But of course, with this, it's less clear. And so that's kind of like the contrast that we're shown in The Magnificent Seven, too.
Yeah.
You know, this horse buckled Chico.
Yeah, really? And it's interesting, Chico? You know, just in our CIA, sometimes you get somebody who says, hey, you know, tomorrow it would be great if I could just be Catholic tomorrow. And I really don't need to go through any of this stuff because, you know, sometimes they say, well, I've been studying this forever. I know exactly what I'm doing, you know, and everybody's still, oh, you know, it's going to wait. But that's like Buchholz. And he gets really upset when he's told no, or he's actually demonstrated no. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, this is not for you. And he just can't accept that. He gets really upset.
Yeah.
And but anyway, he ends up, he doesn't give up. So he proves to Yul Brynner in a different way, you know.
Right.
Through desire, right. I guess, you know. Maybe I'm not ready ingenuity. Now, but really, I am really desireful, you know?
Yeah, and through ingenuity and, you know, trying harder. Well, and, oh, shoot, what was I thinking? Something related to this.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, yeah, and he's the one who's always making little cutting remarks about the villagers. Oh, they'll write a song about you. They write songs about everything in this village, in these kind of villages, and they sing them forever, you know? Yeah. And so
they get to that town, he gives a speech.
And eventually, Yul Brynner's like, you know what? He goes, yeah, because you came from a village just like this, okay? We get it. And he suddenly stops and gives this little speech about where he's talking as one of the villagers. He says, yes, I do come from one of these villages. And why are we like this? Because people like you, like me, made us this way. Hmm. How can we be blamed?
No.
And it was interesting to have him suddenly take on the voice of the villagers, the people who are constantly oppressed like that.
Yeah. Yeah. That was interesting.
So,
yeah, again, interesting casting choice, yeah. You know, this German, as the Latino.
I guess they figured, it's close enough to a Mexican accent. He's got dark hair. Okay.
That's funny. So yeah, as we were watching it, I watched it with my daughter. She says her favorite was James Coburn, who plays Britt. Great. Yeah. Didn't say much, but yeah,
that's
he was
his way.
Yep. Yeah. But it was neat to see these guys. I thought it was cool.
Oh, well, I love these ensemble movies like this. Mm-hmm. And you get things like, what is it, Ocean's 11, which that was fine. It wasn't my favorite movie. It was fine.
Mm.
But you don't get a lot of these kind of movies. And I think there seems like there used to be more of them, but maybe that was the end of the old studio system where they were still...
Maybe
trading
so.
People around.
In the extra stuff that I watched about it on the DVD, they were talking about casting of the movie. And one of the things they were up against was there was a strike looming, an actor's strike. So you had to have everybody signed by a certain time. Otherwise, you would have to wait.
Okay.
So at the very end, they were in a big hurry. And Robert Vaughn had been brought on, and he said... He saw James Coburn at the store. I guess they were friends. And he says, hey, you need to get down there.
Friends.
Yeah, you need to get down there and tell him that you're available. So he goes down there and got the part. Just, you know, on that last weekend before they had to finish. And, he said, well, which part would I have? Because he'd seen Seven Samurai.
Oh,
and he said,
okay.
You're going to be the guy with the knives. And he's like, holy cow. That's the one I would have picked anyway. So... It was neat.
Who wouldn't want to be the guy with the knives?
So anyway, so that's interesting because, you know, the cast is so vital. It's amazing how, you know, lightning strikes sometimes and it's just like, oh, I can't imagine it any better.
Right.
You know?
Well, yeah, because it's like all those stories about movies like Casablanca where they were considering Ronald Reagan and Ann Sheridan.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, it didn't work out. We're so lucky. It wound up being Charles Bronson. Now I've got him on the brain. But Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman.
Yeah, in the extras, they said that Anthony Quinn was attached to this somehow. And I think ended
he was going to be the James Coburn.
Yeah, I don't know which part he was going to be, but
he's great. Yeah. Oh my gosh!
Yeah,
that would have been something. A great Calvera. Also, now that I think of it, though,
right?
Yeah, it's funny. I've seen so many movies where those actors are at least in them tangentially. It seems like, or just as smaller parts. That you say these names, and they just—I can see the face and hear the voice almost. I wonder. If people still watch these old movies like this, or do they just know about them and refer to them? Kind of like when I watched 12 Angry Men a few weeks ago.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd seen all the jokes and heard all the references, but I'd never seen the actual movie, which sounded so boring. And it was amazing, by the way.
Yeah.
Very sweaty, but amazing. So hot in that jury room. I can't tell you.
Yeah. I actually have not watched a lot of Westerns.
Okay.
But what I have seen a lot of from the same period are the World War II movies.
Right.
You know,
right.
I went through a period where I just watched everyone I could find. And I mean, it's the same group of people, really. You know, like the Dirty Dozen and, you know.
That's got more of an edge, but yeah.
The Eagle has
They're not
landed.
Afraid to get their hands dirty in that one.
Right, and the Alistair MacLean, you know, where Eagles Dare and Force 10 from Navarone is a favorite.
Well, it's funny because...
I think Harrison Ford's even in that one.
Well, yeah, and it's funny because I didn't watch those movies because I had read those books by Alistair MacLean so many times, and I kept going, Rock Hudson, that's not who I pictured in that part. No. But I think it's hilarious that I was letting that... this cheap... Well, not cheap, but, you know, this kind of thriller format... identify who I was going to watch in a movie.
Uh-huh.
That's ridiculous. Okay. Well, because instead of this movie, I almost picked The Great Escape.
Really? That's neat.
Yeah.
Which and that's something I want to rewatch that now because same director. Steve McQueen's in it.
Oh, yeah.
And the cool King. Charles Bronson's in it.
Right. And I think James Coburn doing the worst. I think they called him an Australian just to try to cover the horrible accent
it says
he had to do.
Sedgwick the Manufacturer, says IMDb, is what his car was.
Okay. That one, because they have a whole prison camp that's got James Garner, Donald Pleasance. I mean, Richard Attenborough. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's got, oh man, what a cast.
Yeah.
But I was going for a summer movie and The Magnificent Seven. I couldn't resist it.
That's great. I'm glad you did. I just loved it.
Well, you know what?
I do. I'm gonna watch it again before sending it back. I got it from Netflix. In fact, this is something I need to buy because
yes, we own it.
It needs to be on the shelf.
Yeah, the pool room really isn't
the pool room.
The Magnificent Seven, just to pull out every so often and watch. And it's pretty quick. They don't waste a lot of time.
Yeah.
You know. Oh, one thing that I was impressed by, maybe more these days than I was any other time I saw it, were the way that they cast the native Mexicans and showed the celebrations. Because I was talking about the fact that when they're doing this village celebration of their founding, that was it, they're doing this Inca-like dance with, you know, one person's the deer and the other people are the hunters. And I'm sure they had to make it more obvious for us seeing it. But it looked really real to me, and it may not have been.
Well, but that's interesting that you mentioned that, because it was in that extra.
Okay.
And they said that Yul Brynner got married on the set.
Really?
And that was the party for his wedding.
How cool.
And they filmed it, and it was, you know, in Mexico, and they celebrated in this you know, native way or whatever, however you want to say it, and all the, you know. So it was real.
Oh, that's the coolest thing
ever.
Isn't
that something? Yeah.
Because you looked at it and you thought, you know, this isn't like something that most Hollywood people would go, okay, now we need a celebration. Where's some, you know, maracas and whatever. let's get the mariachi band going. Mm-hmm. This was very different. And my husband, when I was talking about that, he said, you know, I wonder where some of these people were cast from, because, and it's, since you said it was in Mexico, he goes, some of those people had almost the kinds of heads and faces that you see on the old Incan statues.
Mm-hmm.
When you see the art, he goes, they looked like they had lived in that land for a long time. And so we were looking at the villagers then and saying, you know, they didn't just cast the pretty people. Yes, the main female lead is almost white looking. We get it. But a lot of the people just looked real. And I really appreciated that. That was, yeah, you know, they,
it was, it was interesting. You know, they even had the lady who played her, and she is Latino.
Oh, I believed that.
Yeah. And, but yeah. It was interesting. They said that they filmed this in Mexico. Mm-hmm. Both those sets were in Mexico. You know, they had what, the frontier town,
oh, right,
and then the Mexican village, right?
Right.
Really, those are your two sets.
Right.
And they actually had to deal with the Mexican government censors.
Because
there was a movie that came out before that that put Mexicans in a really bad light. And they were like, we're not going to do that anymore. So they actually had to, you know, get the script passed. You know, I don't know why they just didn't pack it up and move back to California or something. But for some reason, they really wanted to film it there. And they actually made a couple of script changes. One of them, the major one was the villagers in the original script were just going to go hire some people. And they said, why are we so weak that we can't fight ourselves? And so they said, okay, what we're going to do is go buy guns. And then they end up hiring guys.
Because they have to, they don't have the expertise.
Exactly. So rather than say, oh, we're so weak, we need to go do this, they're ready to fight. It's just that the guys are cheaper.
And that makes it a stronger movie,
it
actually.
It does. It really does. It's actually a good change.
And you've
but
then
it was the Mexican
some
government that made him do that.
That's interesting. Well, the thing I saw, I didn't see that since I didn't watch the extras, which now I wish I'd have thought about it, but mm-hmm. I just don't. But I did look at Wikipedia, mm-hmm. and they were saying that they didn't want them to have soiled garments. You know, the white peasant clothes should be clean all the time. And mm-hmm. actually, that's one of the points that I kept looking at going, their clothes could not have possibly been that white.
Right.
They would have been out working in the fields or whatever they're doing. You've got white clothes. I get it. No dye, but they get dirty. Why wouldn't you have some dirt on these clothes? And occasionally you would see it, but usually it was just pristine. And I thought, to me, that was the most fake part of the whole thing. And I understand what they were doing. I get mm-hmm. it. Not the dirty peasants. And
right. Right.
But it was just kind of interesting.
One thing that made me laugh out loud about that extra was they were talking about, you said the first scene that they shot was the line of horses going through the stream, you know, on the way to the thing. They filmed this first.
Mm-hmm.
And they said they did three takes of it. And every single time, every one of these actors, you know, talking about egos and things, would do something to try and be noticed in this scene. Like Steve McQueen would lean down with his hat and get water and pour it over his head as he was riding by. And, you know, Yul Brynner was in front. He wasn't doing any of this, you know,
right.
So he had no idea what was going on behind him. And then, you know, Charles Bronson would do, you know, like open his shirt. James Coburn would do something. I can't remember exactly, but they said that the director just looked over at his assistant and was like, oh my gosh, this is going to be 6 weeks
of
one-upmanship.
You get all these stars and they're used to it. It's I was sorry to hear about it because it kind of ruined a little bit of my crush on these guys, but it is also human nature. And that's kind of an interesting point. So thinking about it just for the podcast, here's the front they show to the world.
Mm-hmm.
They're all comrades for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
They're heroes. We can really admire them. And even if they have their flaws, you know, Robert Vaughn's got his own problems and everything. And mm-hmm. the guy who's looking for treasure, they're generally admirable people. But behind the scenes, the real people have feet of clay. There's no one who's so perfect.
Right, right.
I mean, the only person I have ever come across that I've read about from Hollywood who is as nice or nicer than you think they're supposed to be is Jack Benny.
Hmm. Interesting.
because I have this book called Permanent Californians, and it's about going around to some of the big graveyards in different places and looking at the what kind of monuments are left, and then they'll talk about the lives of the people. And I had to quit reading the section on L.A. because it was so depressing, how the people were actually horrible, or their careers had turned them into just awful people, or they were so disappointed that they came to very tragic ends through trying to achieve fame. And the only one who, I mean, I'm thinking of even some of the people you think are the nicest had these feet of clay. And the only one who was actually just a sterling person was Jack Benny. And he was always a comic, but he presented himself to the world as, you know, he was stingy. He was all these various things. I don't know if you've ever paid attention to Jack Benny. Rose has been listening to old radio shows. Yeah, and she's come across Jack Benny, Bing Crosby, and Jimmy Durante's shows. So we were talking about him, and I have just enough exposure from the very fringes of seeing reruns and that kind of thing when I was a kid. So, you know, those old reruns where you're like, ugh, why is this horrible old black and white thing on? Well, I'll watch it. It's all that's on. The days before cable.
Yeah, yeah.
And he actually was very altruistic and kind to everyone behind the scenes, that kind of thing.
That's
but everybody else had these, you know, I'm going to get more attention from the camera. And so what does that say about us as people? We have, that's why it's so hard for us as Christians.
Well,
we're having to fight this essential urge to, I want to be important somehow.
Right. Welcome to Facebook.
That's what I,
you know, social media can be really good, but what's bad about it is when people do things to try to get noticed. It's you know, it encourages bad behavior.
Welcome to the world of selfies.
Yes.
How many pictures of myself can I or my friends or my husband or whoever put up? Oh, I'm just standing here.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, they happen to catch a fabulous picture of me. I'll just make sure it's posted. Really?
Yeah. I know. It's tough.
You know.
Yeah. But at the same time, you know, the internet lets us connect. You know, without the internet, I wouldn't know you.
Right.
So, I mean, there's a lot of good to be had out of the internet, but man, it sure tugs you in the wrong direction a lot. It just feeds this part of you that you're talking about that these actors have.
Yeah.
And, you know, we all have that.
It's,
you know,
yeah.
So, I mean, we all want to be noticed and we all want this and we all want that. And
it's kind of a concentration of everyday life, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, how much can you step back and let the other person be noticed for who they are instead of shoving yourself in front?
Yeah. Yeah.
How secure are you in a sense?
Mm-hmm.
The other thing it makes me think of is there's that new, is it Sofia Coppola movie that's called Bling something? And it's about
the
that
Bling ring. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. The ring of kids that, well, like young adults, I guess, that.
Yeah. Emma Watson's in that. I've seen the ads for that, right? They actually break into famous people's houses and steal things.
Right.
Yeah.
And one of the ways they were caught is because if you're going to, right after you stole a bunch of identifiable stuff from a celebrity, take pictures of yourself holding it and put it on Facebook, that makes it easier to catch them.
It sure does. So that's based on a true thing? Yeah.
Inspired by
actual events.
And
how about that?
In fact, Paris Hilton, who was a victim of theirs, let them use her place to film in.
How about that?
But the thing I thought was interesting was one of my movie podcast. Well, in fact, about the only movie podcast I listen to these days is the Movie Date from the Takeaway.
Mm-hmm.
Now that Roger Ebert is dead, and rest in peace, Roger. You know, I don't have that anchor against which to kind of go, okay, here's the base. Now, where's everybody else going, and how can I judge the movie? Really, they're kind of turning into it. It's, you know, a guy and a girl who talk about the movies, and they're both movie critics and that kind of thing. And they were saying that what they found interesting was it's talking about, in a sense, showing you that atmosphere of the cult of celebrity. These kids aren't celebrities, but by having the things that the celebrities have and being where the celebrities are, they feel it makes them into celebrities. And then by putting their pictures on Facebook, they're celebrities. They think they don't have to do anything. This is all they have to do.
Yeah.
I thought that was an interesting comment from those movie critics on that.
Yeah, that is an interesting comment. Yeah. Yeah, it's worth a lot of thought. So it's interesting.
And it's hard to keep from getting sucked in. It's because it's addictive. And not the maybe the showing yourself or whatever, but just interacting in social media.
Yeah.
Yep. Like for me, it's Goodreads. Mm-hmm. I've been having to start telling myself, no, you just need to look at it once a day. You don't need to be in there commenting, reading what everybody says. That's a time suck.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it is. But it also, you know, some like Goodreads, you know, there's a lot of good to be had too. But, you know, I guess moderation in all things, right?
Right. That's kind of what I was saying.
Yeah, that's kind of where it needs to be. But, you know, when you start to do things like, you know, and I've done this before where you're like, well, geez, you know, I can't possibly keep up, you mm-hmm. know, so you feel like, you know, maybe your self-worth is not, it's affecting your self-worth. And that's where you're in the wrong area. You know, you're like, no, this is not right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But then you start to do stuff to try to, I don't know. It's like get attention. That's really the same mm-hmm. thing. It's the same thing on Twitter, same thing on Facebook. I can easily see how a person can just fall right into this thing where they need to be posting on this in order to get noticed. And mm-hmm. they start to do things in their real life in order to have something to post.
Yeah.
And that's the reason for doing what they're doing is because, hey, Facebook will think this is pretty cool. And that's where the dangerous comes in.
Yeah, and I first ran into that in the blogging world when that was mm-hmm. all there really was. And I never really tried to do that as much because I just, okay, people, when I have 8 posts a day, it's just because I like to talk a lot. And look at all these neat things I found, blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
And I never really cared about comments that much. It's fun when I get them. And reviews, don't get me wrong, but I would see people who would write post after post after post complaining about all these people are like the cool ones in the high school lunchroom and I'm left here by myself. Nobody comes and reads and nobody comments. And the friends would flock around and comfort them and they'd feel great. And then eventually, you know, things level out. And it's like, I would just always be going, don't you have a life? Why is this where you're getting your self-worth? I'm so sad.
Yeah, yeah.
Not that I'm flawless. I have my own issues. I just don't have them in that point right now. You know, I'm not trying to say I'm better. I'm just saying when I saw that, maybe it was a reinforcement for me that, you know, you don't need to put that stuff out there because I look at my feelings hurt too. Mm-hmm. Oh, somebody was picked for this. Oh, somebody was picked for that. This blogger gets to do this. How come everybody links to that blogger? They never even notice me. And then I'm like, is that the point? Mm-hmm. Stop it.
Right.
And then
right.
I have to just write that down on my list for confession. You know, that this is a tendency for me. I have to watch it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So these guys had nobody, these actors, to get back to the movie. They mm-hmm. only had each other putting them in check or some poor director who was clutching his brow going, oi, they.
Yeah, it had all seemed almost in good fun, you know, now looking back at it. But yeah, that's funny stuff. I don't know that they were.
About the mounds of dirt that Steve McQueen and Yul Brynner would make for themselves to make themselves look taller next to each other, and the other one would come by and kick it away. And you're like, oh, that's terrible.
That is funny.
That's an inner weakness that, I mean, I'd like to think it was in good fun.
Mm hmm. I'd like to think Charles, so too, but yeah.
Charles Bronson and James Coburn, let it be in fun. Leave me some illusions, please.
Shoot. Heck yeah. I never forget the first, you know, Star Trek insider stuff that I ever read. And they were saying, you know, Bill Shatner, nobody liked him. And they're like, what?
Captain Kirk.
Like, oh no. Like, oh, I'd rather just not know that, you know.
I know. And that's where we have to have separation between the stories we're told, mm-hmm. the value that the stories have for us versus the real life thing.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
You know,
yeah.
It's kind of the ideal. We're shown the ideal.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fact that it's really hard to live up to. It's almost kind of like King David in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's this young hero. He comes and he defeats David and Goliath. He's nothing but wonderful to King Saul, plays the harp or lyre or whatever it is he plays for him when he's got these horrible headaches. When Saul's trying to kill him, he just runs away rather than attack him. He turns down chances to kill him when he's sleeping. Then he's king. He's got everything. And what does he do? Oh, that lady I saw bathing on the roof, Bathsheba, bring her to me. Oh, her husband's kind of in the way. And I can't get him to not be the greatest guy ever, so I can pretend this baby that's coming might be his. I'll just send him away. Hey, guys, send him out here and then pull back and leave him by himself. I mean, how can you get worse than that? More calculating and horrible, because we forget ourselves.
Right.
And if you really thought of all the time about how it looks to other people, maybe it might stop you.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a value that confession has for me, actually.
Yeah, that's really, yeah. I need to go more often, but I mean, yeah.
Don't we all?
But it's a remarkable thing, really.
It stopped me a few times from, you know, I'll be kind of going, huh? And then I'll go, suddenly, maybe it's my guardian angel going, Julie, really, you're going to have to tell somebody this later, because I take confession seriously, everybody. I will tell stuff. And I'm like, oh, no, I'm not telling that to the priest. Nope, not going to do it. Thank you for saving me from myself.
Yeah.
What makes me want to do this? Let me think about it and try to get to the bottom of that. So
yeah,
it's a correction.
That's what
me.
It does. It helps you get to the bottom of it.
Yeah, because you can't just not do it. You've got to think about what is it that makes me even want to do this.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
Right, right. Well, shoot. Well, that's a wonderful movie.
Good, I'm glad.
Thank you so much. And seriously, I am going to watch it again before I send it back.
I just want to say one thing that, you know, Texas was mentioned in this movie. Because
I love
Calvera's telling the story about why he stayed south of the border. And he says, I went and robbed a bank and the whole Texas army came after me. And he goes, and so now I understand. In Texas, only Texans can rob banks.
Wow.
And he gives this big laugh. And Tom pointed out, he says, there's the essential difference. And I guess that got past the censors between Mexico and the way they handled things. And Texas or the United States, they would go and take care of something. They're like, we can't have this guy continually doing raids. Let's stop them. Versus, well, we can't have the federales hanging out here forever, probably taking bribes. But, you know, and so guess what? We can't help you. We're not going to go get them. We're busy.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
Good for Texas.
That's what I said. I'll save you from singing the song.
You bet. Hey, I've got some sad news. This is the other day. Just yesterday, Richard Matheson passed away.
Oh,
made me very sad. Yeah, Richard Matheson, who wrote "I Am Legend" and
Incredible Shrinking Man, that I don't like, but made into books I do like.
Yeah, exactly. Oh. And I was just talking to Tam, and Tam was saying, "Wow, it's been quite a year." And I don't know. I just kind of looked around, and we've lost Jack Vance, Andrew Greeley, right? Who was a priest. I've read a couple of his books.
Right.
Vince Flynn, who's a thriller writer.
Yeah.
A guy named Park Godwin, who I've read one or two of his books.
I know the name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's kind of a fantasy.
And Ian Banks is really sick.
Yeah, Ian Banks is the other one I have down there.
We're talking about.
Guy named Rick Hatala, who's a New England horror writer.
Okay.
But yeah. Prayers for all of those folks.
Mm-hmm.
Rest in peace.
Yeah. And for the people that miss them.
Yes.
Close to them. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess you kind of go through these waves of, you know, generations or years of people that kind of came along at a time when they could be really prolific and make a difference in a field. Because I think at the beginning of the year, I listened to a podcast called Music from 100 Years Ago.
Mm-hmm.
And every year at the beginning, he'll do something talking, a tribute to the people who've died that year or during the last year. And there were a lot of jazz people. Wow. Unusually. Mm-hmm. So I think he did a two-parter on that one.
How about that?
Yeah.
That's one thing I did like about the Oscar. I assume that they do this every year. I don't watch it, but when they do kind of the retrospective and, you know, show you who passed away, that's you know, tough to watch, but yeah.
But it's an important, you know, any of us could step out the door and get, I don't know, hit by a meteor.
Yep.
I mean, that's kind of also, people think that's gloomy of Catholics to kind of always keep that in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't really go around thinking about it a lot. But those are also kind of, in a sense, correctives of what's important in life right now. And where are we going ultimately? Because that's the whole point is, what did the Baltimore Catechism always say? To know and love God and work, serve him in this life and be happy with him in the next.
Right, right.
Which is such a beautiful way to put it. And can we be happy with him in the next life? That's kind of what this is boot camp for. We're kind of in training to get ourselves in shape for it.
Sure.
Which is a simplistic way of putting it. When he claps his hands, can we get our gun barrel between? That's what I want to know.
That's the important thing.
Am I prepared?
That's right. That's right.
Now I'm going to always think of the Simpsons picture of God clapping his hands and me trying to get my gun barrel out in time.
Oh, funny.
Oh, if I'm hit by lightning today, we'll know why.
Oh, that's great. All right. Well, okay. Yeah, okay. Again, thanks very much. Oh, so what do we got coming up now?
Let's see. Now we have a trip to India.
Yes.
In The Clue of the Missing Servant by, is it Tarquin Hall?
Tarquin Hall, yeah, The Case of the Missing Servant.
Case of the Missing Servant, right. Okay. Yes.
And then after that, we're going to do Apollo 13.
Excellent movie.
And then after that, we're going to read a book called Kirin Yaga by Mike Resnick.
A trip to Africa via outer space, in a sense. I understand.
Exactly. Yep.
I haven't read it, but...
That is right.
I do actually have the audio version, I think.
Oh, cool.
You know, I say won it, but I think I read for SFF Audio when they were doing their prizes. And
Jesse
had that as a prize, and I think he sent it to me. I think that's where I got it.
Okay. Yeah, good audiobook.
Yeah, I just haven't listened to it because it sounded like it had some tough subjects in it. And I was always like, I'll get to that later.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yep. Okay.
And then we'll go into our tri-annual faith.
Yeah, that's right.
Focus. And I'd say lighter. Well, and then we'll have, I've picked the movie. It's called Ush Pizin. Mm-hmm. I think that's how you say it. It's an Israeli movie.
Okay.
But it's pretty light, you know. It's not of gods and monsters or whatever it was that we saw of gods and men. That was it.
Right.
Let's get those two titles mixed up. And then not light at all, but quicker to read than Jesus of Nazareth, The Hiding Place by Corrie Ten Boom.
Yeah, that's going to be good.
Yeah.
Great.
So, so we've got quite the summer lineup.
Yes, we do. It's exciting.
Yeah.
Well, good. Okay. Well, have a good couple of weeks, everybody.
Yes.
And we'll see you next time. All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.